You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
I will tell you, this is historic, it's epic, what happened... But you know what? It happened in Texas, and Texas can handle anything.
Donald Trump there extolling the Lone Star State's resilience in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. But as the city of Houston imposes a curfew to mitigate against looting, its effect on the city's social fabric has only just begun. My guests, Terry Stiassny and John Everard, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including a look at how the world is reacting to a North Korea that refuses to budge on its missile testing program. As opposition in Venezuela are threatened with charges of treason, and Guatemala's highest court protects a UN corruption investigator from expulsion by the president, we take stock of democracy in Latin America. Plus, how to deal with your literary estate? The late Terry Pratchett offers a unique answer to this vexing question. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests today are the author and journalist Terry Stiassny and former British diplomat John Everard. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you with us. Hurricane Harvey has passed Houston, but the city's ordeals have really only just begun. On television, in newspapers, on social media, the destruction has been illustrated mainly through the personal stories of those affected. But the bigger picture of the storm's impact on society could be more profound yet, and is as yet unknowable. John Everard, I'll come to you first of all. The pictures have been shocking, and obviously the impact is still being measured in terms of the loss of life and the destruction. Is it too soon to look at, I don't know, what more this tells us about a society in the United States that is divided, that seems rather polarised, where the leadership seems often out of step with its citizens? Or do you think it's as good a time as any to scrutinise exactly that sort of thing?
The Chinese have a saying that it rains alike on the rich and the poor, but the rich have umbrellas. And I think this is something of what we are seeing in Hurricane Harvey, that those with any kind of means have got out of the area. They may have lost property, although many have managed to salvage that. The people who have really suffered are those at the bottom end of society. And, of course, there's these heart-rending tales of what's happened to the 600,000 or so undocumented migrants who seem to be trapped there, who are unable to leave homes, which often officially they don't own. And because they don't actually appear in any federal registers, they're not being looked for by the federal agencies. Yes, I think this has shown up in a big way, the divisions in America. Also, the problems over the flood insurance scheme, which was, you remember, set up rather before Katrina, with the specific aim of helping people who would otherwise struggle economically to recover from just this kind of natural disaster. Now, $24 billion in the red, simply unable to pay its debts, and most unlikely to be able to make any kind of payouts for those who suffered worst from this hurricane.
And Terry, that is, and that stat was astonishing to me about the 600,000 undocumented migrants. It's the most in the United States of anywhere other than New York City and Los Angeles. And when we come on to Trump and what he's had to say and his performance around this in a moment, but I wonder, I mean, where do you think the most trenchant questions are asked? Is it about, you know, the failure of flood defences, this kind of thing, which happened, of course, in the aftermath of New Orleans? Or is it more about the lack of, I don't know what you'd call it, almost joined up thinking, which John is reflecting on there?
Well, I think what we're going to see is there's going to be a lot of conflict about this further down the line. Obviously, in the immediate aftermath of floods like this and weather like this, the main priority is saving people on the ground, trying to get people back in their houses. What you saw after, for instance, Hurricane Sandy, is you're going to have these big congressional battles about money. It comes down to boring things like money and infrastructure. And if you look at what the president's priorities are at the moment, I mean, yes, he's saying that Mexico is going to pay for the wall. But if it comes down to making a decision, do you pay for a wall to keep out some of the undocumented immigrants, or do you pay to rebuild the interstate through Houston, or to rebuild housing, or to, you know, to rebuild people's schools? Those priorities are going to look a lot more pressing. And we saw that in New York, there were elected representatives from places like Texas who didn't want to pay for rebuilding places in New York. Now, you know, is that going to happen in reverse? Are people going to say that, well, look, we don't want to go spending money that we haven't got on big projects like this? So, you know, there are going to be a lot of domestic priorities that are going to come into conflict. And if you look at one of the quotes from one of the ratings agency, Moody's, was already estimating that there could be $65 billion worth of damage and loss, including the amount that's lost to the economy. And of course, you know, Houston's hugely important in terms of things like the oil industry as well. So there are going to be some very long-term consequences, and it will be interesting to see how that plays out.
And John, on Donald Trump, it was interesting. I mean, at the latest of his sort of foot-in-mouth moments, he was sort of caught on tape sort of saying, oh, what great turnout today, as essentially a crowd of affected people who had, maybe some of whom had lost their homes, had convened and congregated together. He hailed the turnout and said, you know, what a crowd. I've asked you this question so many times before. Does that just demonstrate how out of touch he is and how self-regarding he remains, even when confronted with the plight of the people he is supposed to be representing?
Well, the quick answer to your question is yes, it does, and yes, he is. But I think beyond that, it's very interesting and probably long-term significant to see the way he's been panned on social media. Mm. I mean, Trump has this kind of, you know, almost completely adherent base for whom he can do no wrong. But outside that, the kind of grey zone that actually got him his presidency are now deserting him in droves. And the kind of comments that have been made about his speech, about his reaction to this terrible natural disaster, suggests that a lot more people are rethinking their support for Trump now. He's coming across as self-obsessed. Well, we probably knew that anyway, didn't we? But incapable of responding to human misery, incapable of demonstrating compassion. And I think a lot of previously, you know, solid Trump supporters were looking for that in their president and have been bitterly disappointed to find those qualities absent.
And Terry, on that point about, there's been a couple of interesting pieces I've read in the papers today in the New York Times about the optics of politicians. I know it's a phrase and an idea, I think, beloved of spin doctors and their ilk rather than your sort of man in the street. But it's quite interesting. Some of these pieces have said, look, you know, Melania Trump turned up with her, you know, crazy Manolos, whatever she was wearing, and her FLOTUS hat. Oh, what naivety, what misjudgment. And a couple of these pieces, perhaps counterintuitively, said, no. That is the Trump message, which is, you know, we're from money. We're not your career politicians who are going to come out with the kind of niceties that you'd expect from us. We're different. That's not what we're about. And it's quite calculated and it's quite deliberate. A controversial reading. Can you
find
any truth in that?
It is. I mean, I don't know, certainly within the British context, you know, if the Prime Minister goes to a flood and is wearing the wrong kind of wellies, they get all sorts of abuse. You can't imagine, Theresa May is famous for her shoes, but you can't imagine her turning up in her leopard print stilettos. You know, she would make sure to have the wellies because, as you say, the optics would be right. Maybe it is, as you say, it's sort of on brand for Melania Trump. She doesn't want to look, you know, her brand, you know, she's used to looking glamorous. Maybe she thinks, I don't know, maybe she thinks that there are people who respect her for that. I'm not sure, but they don't think about it in a traditional way. And as John was just saying, you know, Trump's default mode is, this is the biggest hurricane ever, this is the biggest floods ever. He sort of somehow thinks that's great. And, you know, obviously hopes to get the reaction of people saying, you know, yes, Texas is resilient. He's not someone that's going to go to a soup kitchen and dole out ladlefuls of soup as sort of Obama might have done. It's just not how he works. So maybe that's just their default setting in the way of thinking. Maybe they think that works for them. Maybe they think that works with the people who support them, as you say.
Simple technical point, do we think Melania Trump has any ordinary clothes? I mean, I suspect her entire wardrobe is top-of-the-range glam.
I would love to have been the aide that was sent out to go and say, can you buy her some wellies?
Yes, quite.
There must be a set of stout walking boots or something in there from tramping around an estate somewhere or other.
I don't think she
not.
Probably walks very much. She probably gets in taxis.
Or a sedan chair, maybe. John, just coming back to this, it's interesting to reflect on, we talk about the aftermath of Katrina and New Orleans, and many in America and many in Washington, D.C. said, look, never again, whether that was the failures of different government administrative departments, a lack of joined up thinking, or the fact that, you know, the richest, most powerful country in the world seemed to have been unprepared for and incapable of dealing with a natural disaster within its own borders. And yet here we are, ripple dissolve, and the same questions and the same problems in a country where there seems to be greater friction even than there was during the sort of Bush administration at that time. Is this a country that hasn't learned the lessons even of its recent past?
Yes, I think that's a fair comment. One of the commentators on this disaster has said that it shows that America is actually quite good at flood relief. I mean, sure enough, a flood relief operation swung in and started rescuing people very quickly, but it is terrible at flood prevention. It's the long-term planning, the really banal stuff like building your levees to the height that you're required, putting your sluice gates in the right places. None of it is rocket science and you know, easily within America's grasp, but there's never quite enough money for that when the television cameras pan away.
And it is money. I mean, we've talked about this already. It is money rather than an appetite for the big plan that's the problem, you think?
I think it's money, but money and the appetite for the big plan tend to kind of go hand in hand. I mean, money in America, perhaps more than in most Western democracies, flows through the fingers of politicians rather than through few bureaucrats. And you're building a levee which your successor may get electoral credit for just doesn't appeal to a lot of American politicians. In fairness, I mean, given the size of the downpour that we've just seen, it's not at all clear that any amount of levee building would have actually saved all those lives, but better levees would have saved quite a lot of them.
Well, Terry, I mean, perhaps that's the point. In the US, I mean, it's a number of, I don't know what you'd call them, sort of scientists and various observers said, look, this is not a place where you can ever mitigate against this, exactly as John said. And perhaps, you know, in 10 years' time, there'll be another disaster of this nature. Is it time to reappraise, you know, whether it is safe to and sensible to reinvest on the kind of scales that are necessary here?
Well, I think there's a few things going on here. One is that obviously in the States, you always get the tension between what the federal government can do and what state and local government can do. And if you have a federal government that ideologically doesn't want to spend lots of money, it doesn't believe in big, you know, FDR style works programs. I mean, Trump talks about getting people back to work, but again, he doesn't necessarily want to put the money. On the bigger level still, this is somebody who doesn't want government paid scientists talking about climate change as a problem. And if those scientists are right and extreme weather events, which you obviously get a lot in the States, you get hurricanes, you get tornadoes, if those events are going to become more frequent, as the science would suggest, you know, you've got to start listening to the people that tell you, well, a once in 500 year flood might happen once every 250 years. So you've got to accept that premise before you start even thinking about how much money you're going to put into flood prevention. So, you know, you've got to change some big ways of thinking to be able to deal with those problems.
And something tells me Trump maybe is not one for accepting the efficacy of scientific advice. Maybe just my observation. Let's move on to North Korea now. The country's announced that the firing of a missile over northern Japan yesterday was only the first step of a series of operations it has planned. The launch was clearly meant as a provocation. It was the first time North Korea's official news agency admitted a missile was deliberately fired across Japan. The UN called the launch outrageous, but showed no sign of toughening sanctions. With North Korea intransigent and no end to the missile tests in sight, how is this unmoved mover shaping the thoughts, deeds and words of the world around it? John Everard, you know this peninsula better than most, and we often ask you about it. How is this shaping up? Theresa May's made a bit of an entreaty to China today, which sounds maybe like wishful thinking. What have you made of the last 24 hours?
Yes, the entreaty to China is certainly wishful thinking. The Chinese have come out and said pretty much that. What I make of them? Kim Jong-un is showing that he is not going to be cowed by American pressure. He is not going to be bribed by American money. He has decided that he is going to achieve a deliverable nuclear warhead, one with which he can threaten the continental United States, and he is going to go and do it. Nothing is going to stop him now. There's a form of words that the North Koreans keep using, which is repeated in their statement early today, but which was first put out by Kim Jong-un himself 3-4 weeks ago now, which says, we are not going to negotiate our nuclear weapons, we are not going to be dissuaded from further tests, and it keeps getting trotted out. That's their position. So, yes, this is just the start, as they said. There will be further tests. They need further tests because the Hwasong-12 missile that they fired today, is new. It was only actually paraded back in April. There are big stage whispers that, in fact, this is not a homegrown triumph of North Korean technology. They nicked the blueprints from a Ukrainian rocket factory. So they've been putting this together hastily, and they still need to make sure that it will fire reliably every time. They have said that they will fire into the sea, quite specifically. So they are not threatening to dump missiles on anybody's land territory at the moment. But it's very hard to see a happy ending to this story. They're going hell for leather. There's no prospect for dialogue. Both sides have ruled that out. Sanctions have pretty much come to the end of the road. And military options are deeply unappealing. The world has run out of options.
A sobering thought, to say the least. And of course, Japan, Terry was involved here. Where does this leave Japan, do you think? We mentioned that Theresa May, she was meeting Abe today. And Japanese militarism. Abe's had these reforms. The country sort of pushing this idea of this pacifist constitution. I mean, Japan, like so many of the actors here, are also in an unenviable position.
Well, yes, I would agree with John. It's very hard to see what options the rest of the international community has, short of actually using force, which nobody, you know, most people don't seem to want to do. I mean, the interesting question, as you say, for Japan is, you know, it's been bound by its post-war constitution, which hasn't allowed it until very recently to even send troops abroad, to have lots of spending on the military, you know, for obvious post-Second World War reasons. And most people have generally accepted that. But I can imagine that if you were in Hokkaido and, you know, you saw a North Korean missile fire over your head and land several hundred miles over you in the sea, that you might suddenly start to think more differently about that. And that, you know, that is, you know, there has been talk of Japan now acquiring the kind of missiles that could intercept, for instance, missiles which are overflying from North Korea. And I can imagine, you know, there would be, you know, a great deal of domestic debate and discussion about whether that is the right way to approach it, or whether Japan should stick with the way it's been for the last, you know, 70 or so years. So Japan, again, is in a difficult position where what they can hope to do is to, you know, get the rest of the international community to exert pressure through the UN, and, you know, seeing the talks with Theresa May today. But, you know, as John rightly says, it's difficult to know where we go from here. We seem to be in an impasse.
And John, one point just on militarism. One of the Japanese papers this morning, I've forgotten which one it was, pointed out that were it not for the Japanese constitution, that Japan would have been able simply to send a missile back, say it was going to have a, quote, satellite test, unquote, fire a missile over North Korea and splash it down in the sea the other side of North Korea. It would have been a very clear, very strong message which the North Koreans would have understood straight away. But they're not allowed to do that because of the Sultanate ordinances in the constitution. On militarism, I think there's a danger of talking as if Shinzo Abe is intrinsically militaristic. There's very little evidence for that. It seems much more that the man has accepted that the world now is a very different place from the world in which Japan's pacifist constitution was written, and that Japan has to respond to this. And I think, you know, the idea of having the capability to destroy a missile flying over your territory is not unreasonable. And it's not as if, you know, we're talking about aggressive force here.
No, I think it's on a spectrum. It's, as you'd say, in Germany has also increased its the amount that its military can do. It doesn't mean that Germany's becoming militaristic, you know, on a spectrum. You know, these are quite small moves away from the sort of the post-war status quo.
On that point then, John, where does it leave Abe? If we're saying that this is an example of him being a pragmatic politician, he's doing what's politically expedient, because we know that any shift away from that pacifism is pretty domestically, politically unpopular in Japan. Where does it leave him diplomatically? I mean, you basically explicitly said that we're at sort of the end of the road to a degree. I mean, the US was always the only game in town, it seemed, for Japan in terms of military and defence terms. Does that remain the case? Do they need to make their entreaties to Washington now? And what sort of reception are they likely to get from Donald Trump?
Well, they've done it. I mean, almost within hours of the launch, Shinzo Abe and Donald Trump were talking. And I understand it was quite a lengthy telephone conversation. Shinzo Abe, you remember, very Japanese, but the very first thing he did with Donald Trump was not try and talk politics, just to get to know and like the guy, which shows real political skill, if you ask me. But that's by the
point. And commitment, one imagines.
And commitment, yes, also. But he seems to have succeeded. And there is a definite personal chemistry there between the two leaders. So that I suspect that Trump and Abe are generally seen with the same hymn sheet. If there is any kind of frustration in Tokyo at the US response, at US support for Japan at this moment, it's certainly not showing. I mean, the moment you get the sense that the Japanese government is satisfied that the US is with it shoulder to shoulder.
I was going to ask John, actually, is there any chance? I mean, some people look at the collapse of the Soviet Union and almost think that the arms race of the 80s helped bring that on because they were trying to spend so much money that they didn't necessarily have on building bigger and better weapons. Is there a chance that that could happen with North Korea, that North Korea just goes so far all out to spend money on building a nuclear warhead that it just can't sustain the regime anymore?
Yes, that is a possibility. But the external circumstances are very different from those of the Soviet Union. The Chinese have, not officially, but in various semi-official organs, said that in that kind of situation, they might well invade. So that you would then have Chinese troops rushing south to try to stabilize North Korea, probably meeting US troops rushing north to try to grab the nukes. Not in that situation.
To say the very least. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, my guests today, Terry Stiassny and John Everard. Coming up next, democracy under threat in Guatemala and Venezuela and how to deal with that pesky unfinished novel.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Still with me on today's edition of Midori House are the author and journalist Terry Stiassny and former British diplomat John Everard. Today saw two big developments in Latin American politics. In Venezuela, the National Constituent Assembly, convened by President Nicolas Maduro last month after a highly contentious and disputed vote, has unanimously voted to put opposition leaders on trial for treason. Meanwhile, in Guatemala, the country's highest court has intervened to block an order from President Jimmy Morales to expel a UN investigator looking into irregularities in his 2015 presidential campaign. Terry, at the risk of sort of bunching in things together that are unlikely bedfellows, across the continent, ambivalent relationships with democracy we've seen. And if we start with Venezuela, we've been tracking this over a number of months. What's actually at stake here? Because, you know, I guess once your opposition leadership is potentially facing treason trials, you know, that's about as bad as it can get.
I mean, yes, it seems an obvious thing to say, but it does seem to be the collapse of any form of democracy. You've got, you know, this constituent assembly, which has now taken over powers. Once you start arresting people who disagree with you, you know, there's no way that can be called any kind of a democracy anymore. I think it's just really sad to see it, because if you look back, say, 20, maybe 30 years ago, people were hailing the transitions in Latin American countries, saying that they've moved away from authoritarianism, they're moving towards a democracy, and, you know, in a similar way that we sure saw in Eastern Europe. But we thought, this is here to stay, this is here for good. And as developments all over the world have shown, you know, you can't take that kind of democracy and the rule of law for granted. If you look at what's happening in some countries in Eastern Europe at the moment, that is, you know, it's not necessarily an absolute given. And honestly, really entrenched the rule of law there. You know, these new populists, or, you know, been around for a while, I suppose, in Chavez's, you know, terms, these populist movements can easily override it. And it's luckily, I suppose, that in Guatemala, at least, you've got a court that has at least said, you know, no, you can investigate corruption. You cannot just go and take these rights away and throw people out of the country. So, you know, let's hope that prevails. But in Venezuela, it all seems to have gone by the board.
John, do you identify that shift that Terry describes there, which, I mean, I don't know, was there a complacency perhaps from without, that there was a shift away from populist leadership to authoritarian leaders? Did you know, was this something that we were collectively, globally complacent about? Or do you not recognise that kind of large-scale shift?
I think, it's very dangerous to talk about shifts across Latin America. Latin America is very diverse, and different countries move in different directions at different times. The case of Venezuela is particularly interesting because, of course, it's such a well-established, entrenched democracy. Apart from very brief periods of military rule, this is a country that's been ruled by an elected assembly pretty much since its declaration of independence. And I'm not quite as pessimistic about it as Terry. I think, firstly, everybody understands understands inside and outside Venezuela that the Constituent Assembly is just a ragbag of Maduro's rapidly dwindling gang of supporters, to actually do something against the opposition, even if constitutionally you attempt to sidestep the parliament. Firstly, you have to control the streets, which Maduro doesn't. Mm-hmm. The opposition control the streets, and they are quite capable of calling out a cataroleo, as they're called in Latin America, and banging the saucepan to show disapproval any time they like. You also actually have to have a police force prepared to arrest these people. Not at all clear the police would arrest them. They're perhaps a little more independent in places like Venezuela than they are in some Western democracies. And you have to have courts that will convict them. And Venezuela's courts have a noble tradition of standing up to the most pig-headed of presidents. So I suspect that the reaction in the opposition will be anger rather than fear. And I can't help think that when we come to look back on the collapse of the Maduro regime, we'll see this as one of the greatest shots in the foot.
And Terry, on that point, you already alluded to it, that in Guatemala, again, I mean, John's talking about the strength and the independence of the judiciary. As you suggested, the Constitutional Court there has overruled this instruction from the president to expel the head of the UN's anti-corruption mission. And this is funny. He arrived, Jimmy Morales, on essentially an anti-corruption ticket. He was a fresh outsider. He was a comic. He wasn't a politician. He was not a career politician. He was supposed to be untainted by that. Has just political reality caught up with him, do you think?
Well, yes, as you say, he ran on a slogan that was neither corrupt nor a crook. But then when people started looking into this and questioning it and raising questions about precisely about his campaign funding, then he didn't appear to like that at all. I mean, I suppose it's interesting. He comes, as you say, from a background of going into politics with no political experience, being a former comedian and then coming in. And it just shows that politics is a lot harder than we expect it to be. And, you know, I do take John's point. Yes, of course, you shouldn't overgeneralise about, you know, all these different countries that have got very different sets of circumstances. And I think one of the fundamentals that it always comes down to, particularly if you look in the case of Venezuela, the terrible, terrible state of the economy. And I've read some horrific accounts that you've probably covered before about, you know, the extent to which people just haven't got enough to eat, the extent to which people in a country that had always been rich, it had had oil money, the price of oil has fallen. And now there are, you know, people who were not previously hungry, who are now going hungry in the streets. So the question is, I suppose, whether those people, whether that hunger prompts them to rebel, or whether people are just too absolutely exhausted to do so.
Indeed. Time is short on today's programme, and I did briefly want to touch on this final topic. Fans of Terry Pratchett, author of the world-famous Discworld series of novels, will have had mixed reactions to the news that a hard drive containing up to 10 incomplete novels has been destroyed with a steamroller, no less, like a scene from one of his books. It was the fulfilment of a very specific request from Pratchett before his death a couple of years ago. And I wonder whether he set an example for others to follow. John, he didn't want anyone else picking up the loose ends and tying them in a way that he wouldn't have recognised, and left this very specific instructions. Is this, a lofty example for others in the literary firmament, do you think?
Well, yes. If you believe sufficiently in the purity of your work and in the integrity of something that only you can write, then what Terry Pratchett asked to be done is entirely logical. Also, of course, wonderfully flamboyant, very Terry Pratchett. There have been lots of instances of authors asking for unwritten and unfinished works, rather, to be burnt, shredded, whatever, after their death. But how it's smashed by a steamroller? Hey, what's not to like?
And Terry, do you go along with that? I mean, I don't know if you could. There are other examples we had, of course, To Kill a Mockingbird recently, and the controversies around that succession. What do you think about
this? I mean, I respect his wishes, but if we'd gone along with a lot of authors' wishes to have their works destroyed, we wouldn't have the works of Kafka. We wouldn't have the poems of Emily Dickinson. Vladimir Nabokov's son was in a big lawsuit where he published one of his father's unfinished works against the express wishes of his father's will. And so it's always been a very contentious thing. And I think there are some works that we would have lost that perhaps we'd be very glad to have.
This is very difficult. Who should be the arbiter? If not the author themselves, I don't know who to ask. Convene some sort of panel, John, perhaps? I mean,
no, in my view, I mean, Terry's absolutely right. You incur losses, and it's always sad in some ways if an author says, all the stuff I haven't quite got finished, shred it, burn it, stamp it, no, burn it, run over the steamroller. But it is the author property, and I think that should be respected. Sad though it is for the rest of us.
Indeed, a very noble sentiment. John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, amongst other destinations, and Terry Stiathny, the author and journalist. Thank you both for joining us on Midori House. Today's programme was produced by Henry Rees-Sheridan, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sophia Amadi, and our studio manager was David Stevens. My thanks to all of them. Music for you next at 1900. Danny is here with The Entrepreneurs, and we'll have more on all the big stories of the day on the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. We're back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, thanks for tuning in.